This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers. And this show today is sponsored by EasyGrade, which is a new iPhone app for teachers that replaces a cardboard EasyGrader. You'll hear more about them as the show goes on. How are you doing, Bradley?
It's been a good week so far. We just started our second term, and so a quarter of our school year is over, and we are making the march to Thanksgiving and Christmas break. We always say that once we get past our fall festival, we have a fall festival around Halloween, and once we hit that, it's full down tilt till Christmas.
Well, our term just finished, so this I'm halfway through the first week of holidays. We have a two-week holiday at this time in the year. Most state schools in Scotland have 1 week, but we take two. So I'm with you this week and I'm going to be away next week. So we've lined up a special guest, I believe.
Yes.
For next week.
Yes. We've got a wireless expert from Aerohive coming on. It's going to be a great show. We'll talk a little bit about 802.11ac and some deployment tips if you're a school looking to do Wi-Fi, and you know, some potential pitfalls on what a lot of problems that schools run into when deploying Wi-Fi, especially if they're trying to deploy it themselves without using a installation crew or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. It's been a busy week for me too, vis-a-vis Wi-Fi, because I had my guy from Aerohive came back. Because the school's obviously closed this week, we had an opportunity to do some things a bit more disruptive than before. So we spent some time together yesterday just building the school into a number of different subnets, which we'd never had before. We'd always just kind of just about bumped by with keeping our DHCP lease times very low so that everybody could get one and so on. So we've now built out the school into a staff VLAN, a pupil VLAN, and a guest VLAN. So we now have a reasonably secure way to do guest Wi-Fi, a very secure way to do guest Wi-Fi, which we never had before. We just had to kind of give people the password and trust that they wouldn't do anything bad with it. But now we've done that. We've also separated out a different user group in our Aerohive Hive Manager for Apple TVs so that we can make a simpler kind of password that just involves a few digits for Apple TVs to get on the network. That was pretty easy, actually. I was impressed at just how easy that was to put together. I thought it was going to be a little more disruptive and include a little more recabling and so on, but it seems to have worked pretty well.
Well, the branch routers do a really nice job. I've actually got one of those at my house, and they do a nice job. And one of the neat things I love about it, so if you're somebody looking to maybe dabble in Aerohive, you order one of the branch routers and one of the access points and take it home with you and try to tinker with it. And the BR200 actually has power over Ethernet built into two of the ports. And so it's really pretty cool, especially, you know, our church is looking at launching a second campus across town. And it would be there wouldn't be any office space, or just be for the church service on Sundays. And we'll put a BR200 and a 330 Aerohive access point in there, and then we're good to go. I can have the same settings I have here, I'll have there, and I'll have complete visibility into what's going on there from anywhere. And so it's a great tool for branches, for telecommuters. It's really a great tool.
Yeah, my understanding is that we're sort of testing the outer limits of the BR200 capacity, because we have, now that I've got the whole school on Aerohive, I can see the actual numbers of devices that are showing up every day. And we're running consistently about 140 to 150 devices. For a system that's built on just one BR200, that's quite close to its kind of theoretical limit. But so far, so good. Yeah. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, can't wait to hear it.
So a little bit of news. And this is fresh off the press. I just heard about this about an hour ago. Amazon have just announced a thing called WhisperCast for Kindles and Kindle reader applications. And if you remember back to several shows ago, I think it might have been our second or third show, we were complaining about the difficulty of distributing ebooks to large numbers of devices. And WhisperCast, as far as I can tell, it appears to be some kind of mass management for Kindles and Kindle content. Okay, so it seems to offer two different things, as far as I can tell. One is that you can manage Kindles by logging in. The website is whispercast.amazon.com, and you can do things like push proxy settings and parental controls to Kindle devices that are registered to this account. You can enforce a password. You can block the web browser and things like that. And the second thing you can do is you can push both purchased Kindle content and your own documents wirelessly to all the Kindles that are associated with this account.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Do they have
this
any
is free, apparently.
Do they have any sort? I wonder if there's like a device limit, or I wonder, is it meant for a school to deploy, you know, Kindle Fires or to deploy books via the Kindle application?
I believe so. Okay. Yeah, they have got they're selling it for business and education sales. So there's a subsection on that page called Kindle for Organizations, and it says Kindle at School, Kindle at Work, and so on. And there's a couple of case studies there already for elementary schools, high school, one-to-one Kindles, and so on. And it looks quite interesting. I think the million-dollar question for that whole thing is, if I buy 10 copies, can I pull those 10 copies back off those Kindles at a later date? And I can't actually seem to get an answer on that yet from what I've read. It's not absolutely clear. It's certainly clear enough that you could buy a whole bunch of books and push them out, but whether you'd ever be able to get them back and reuse them, which was really at the heart of our conversation a few months ago, I'm not absolutely clear on that yet.
Well, yeah, and of course, my concerns with that is knowing that, let's say, the Kindle application, they're generally more of static books. And I love interactive books that can include, you know, multimedia content. But if I have my choice between a management system that works versus one that's hodgepodge, which in some ways is what we have with Apple, I could see if this all played out the way I guess Amazon's hoping, I could see us, if we had, we'd get all the books from Amazon, the Kindle app is our textbook manager.
Yes, and the thing that is very clear about this is that Whispercast does actually work for the Kindle applications on other platforms as well as actual physical Kindle devices. So it's quite interesting.
Well, we'll have a link for that in the show notes. Yeah, that's. I'm going to check that out. How did I miss that? Where have I been all day?
Yeah, somebody just pushed it to me on Twitter while I was at dinner earlier on. So it's interesting. I'll try and get some more information on that, and we'll maybe talk about it again next show.
Well, this really, we talk about how, and there's always been talk that Apple doesn't do cloud-based services as well as a Google or an Amazon. And this is really one of the places where this is a risk for Apple, because what Apple, I mean, even if we're deploying iPads today and Amazon nails the book distribution, well, let's say, you know, my school is in no danger of moving to the Kindle platform for devices. But let's say 5 years from now, Apple's not really innovated a whole lot, but Amazon is really pushed forward. They have aggressive pricing. You could make a case for this looks to be a comparable platform for us.
Yes. Yeah, I think, to my mind, one of the things that Amazon has that Apple doesn't seem to quite have is the sort of leverage on the publishers. And I guess that the actual rules vis-a-vis a book belonging to a pupil or belonging to a school are unclear at the moment. But I remember a couple of years ago when we just started our iPad program, I had a conversation with one of the managers from the Kindle team in the UK, and he was saying, why don't you deploy Kindle to your kids? And I was like, well, okay, what does that look like? And he said, well, what you do is you'd make 110 Amazon accounts, and then it's like, whoa, okay, come back when you've got something else. And it seems like they've got something else now. So more research into that. I'm going to sign up for it, but we will take a look at that.
Absolutely.
So that's news item number one. And, of course, news item number two, which is the potential bombshell, is Apple's recent announcement of a special event next week. Headlined, "We have a little more to show you." Well, which the world seems to be taking as information leading up to the announcement of a hypothetical iPad mini, about which I know nothing more than anybody else. I'd read the news the same as everybody else does, but it seems to be there's obviously the events happening next week, and there was a leak from I think it was a German retailer. They leaked the specs and the prices in euros. So the theory or the speculation is that it's going to start at an 8 gigabyte device, Wi-Fi only, for €249. It's an interesting price. It's a little bit above what the Nexus 7 and the Kindle Fire sell for in Europe, but it's probably not too much above it.
I don't think they have to be the cheapest to...
No.
I think they just have to be in the ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, when you get to the point where it's like, you can have the Nexus 7 or for £30 more, you can have an iPad, then that's a no-brainer. You know, that £30 is a trivial difference. But if it's, you know, here's $159 for the Nexus 7 and then here's $329 for your first iPad, then that's a big gap to cross.
Yeah, that'll be something that we're really planning out our lease with Apple right now, and I kind of put the brakes on it because I want to see what this thing looks like. I want to see, you know, if it comes out at $249, I could see with a big purchase of 10 or more, maybe 20 or more, getting it for $229. So I just want to see what it looks like, see how the content does, see how the books. I just want to see how all that plays out. Because we could potentially look at, you know, using that. I'm very interested to watch that. Let's just say that.
Yeah, me too. And the speculation, of course, is also that it will be the aspect ratio will be 4:3 and not 16:9, which is what the other tablets of the smaller sizes are. And I think that additional aspect ratio will make it feel a lot like more of a device. I mean, it will physically be larger. There will be more real estate on that. Than there is on a Nexus 7. And I think it'll be interesting to see just, is it literally going to be a smaller iPad where all the apps are just the same? Or will there be something new? I can't imagine there will be a lot of, that they won't have done some work to make it so that you can just run all your iPad apps as is on this smaller device.
Yeah, it seems like when Apple does one of these changes, they make it where existing applications maybe they're not broken. Maybe they need to be updated, but they're not broken. It's kind of like when they released the original iPad, you could run your iPhone apps. The bigger screen iPhone 5, it just letterboxed the older applications. And, and of course, it kills me when we have applications at this point that are not being updated from major developers. I'm going to call out Dropbox here. How they don't have an iPhone 5 optimized app, I don't understand.
Yeah, I agree. So, iPhone 5 is not too jarring as long as you have a black iPhone, I think.
That's
true.
If you
have a white iPhone, it's much more obvious that you've got these black bars.
Yeah, that's true. My wife's got a white one, and I have a black one. Are you still enjoying it after, I guess, a week or two of having it?
Absolutely, yeah. I've become addicted to playing Pocket Planes, which is it's like Tamagotchi for adults. So don't get involved in playing that game.
Well, I've been hooked on a game called Carcassonne. I think it's how you say it. Carcassonne. It's a German board game. Mm-hmm. And I've got a buddy that plays it, and we play it over Game Center, and I've become addicted to it. I'll put a link in the show notes. But it's kind of like a strategy game, but again, it kind of comes from Germany.
Okay, cool. Well, shall we get into our topic, which is our follow-up from last show? Last show, we kicked off talking about the various steps and the various things that you have to think about in order to plan a successful iPad deployment. And we had several things on our list, and we only got about a third to a half of the way through that list. So shall we just get into it?
Let's go.
Okay. One item of follow-up from the previous show I wanted to mention was that we talked about health topics associated with the use of iPads in school. And one of the things that I wanted to mention that I forgot to mention was considering the issues around glare and lighting in the classroom as a potential health issue for eye strain and so on. Our school is not particularly well designed in that respect. It's just a very typical fluorescent tube lights overhead and so on. And what I've noticed with that is that the kids end up holding their iPad at strange angles just to avoid the glare. You know, they'll stand it much more upright than the normal keyboard case would lay it out as. So that's just something to be aware of. And it's not something that's easy to predict how you would change that ahead of time, but it's something you can perhaps be guided by a little bit of experience on as well. Second thing, or this is probably the fourth thing or the fifth thing now, is acceptable use policy, which is a big one. And one of the things about AUP is that when you get into a one-to-one situation and mobile devices and so on, you start to bring in a lot of different scenarios that your previous policies may not have even considered as being possible. Number one is the possibility of unsupervised access to computers. When you have one-to-one, you cannot guarantee that every minute somebody's touching a computer, somebody's watching them do it. You can do your best in class, but there will always be times. So that's something to recognize. But also, if you get into, for example, devices going home, you're now in a scenario where school equipment is going out of school. And not only is it going out of school, but it's going off network onto other networks. So you have to be very clear about where you claim responsibility and where you claim authority for your acceptable use policy. And the final scenario, which is a little different, is the possibility of personal devices coming into school. Now, that's not something that you bring in if you start using iPads one-to-one. That's something that's happening anyway, and your AUP should probably already recognize that situation, but it's just something to think about while you're revising. So one of the issues with that is, obviously, if you're using any kind of network-level filtering in the building or on-premises and the devices go off that network, there's not a whole lot you can do about that, at least with relatively current technology. I don't know if you've had any thoughts about that, but there's certainly this new feature in iOS 6 called the Global HTTP Proxy, which you can potentially leverage to enforce some filtering and some protection on devices regardless of which network they're on.
I was actually talking to a friend on Twitter over Skype earlier, and we were working through some Apple configurator issues, and we were actually talking about that setting. And, you know, in some ways, I would love it if there was a setting, you know, where I could just say simply always use these DNS servers regardless of anything, and just set it to, you know, OpenDNS Family Shield, and then they're covered. But This, you know, if you don't want to go to the route of the global proxy, I think you just really need to over-communicate to their parents that you don't have control over what they see on the internet when they leave campus. Now, certainly, if you wanted to put a disabled Safari and put a family-friendly browser on there, you have that option. I'm not a fan of that because that breaks a lot of built-in features, like clicking a link in Safari. There's no – now, if you could change the default browser – we wouldn't be having this discussion. But I'm not a big fan of disabling Safari because it does kind of just break some of the aspects of the iPad, in my opinion.
So much of the workflow in iOS is URL-based, and a lot of that stuff that are sort of special cases for Safari, things like subscribing to iTunes U courses, and I haven't tested a lot of that in Chrome, but certainly a lot of the lesser browsers, I mean, a lot of these things where you replace Safari with a controlled browser, those browsers are not really the same quality as either Chrome or Safari.
Well, and they're just not as fast on the iPad because they don't get access to the same JavaScript engine. Because I can really vouch for that because I use 1Password's built-in browser, honestly, probably 50% of the time at this point on my iPad. It just, you can click it, and it takes you right there and logs you in. And I can really tell a difference in pages loading on that versus pages loading on general Safari. And so I think I would get to a place where you'd really discuss it with your parents that they've got to monitor what their kids are doing on their iPad when they're at home.
Yeah, that's pretty much the situation we've been in for the past couple of years. And the thing is, it's not as if the iPad that you send home in most cases is going to be that child's first computing device at home. It's not like these families don't have other devices in general. So it's a broader conversation that's worth having, I think, even if you do think about putting something on. Now, I actually did some experiments this week, holiday time, so it's experiment time. I was looking at, is it possible to use some kind of virtualized server as a global proxy? So I was using some instances on Amazon EC2, and I looked at installing Smoothwall, which I gave up on quite quickly. And then I looked at installing Squid as a proxy on an Amazon EC2 server, and that could be made to work, but Squid is a little bulky at certain things and quite low level when it comes to configuring it. And the last thing I looked at was Sophos have acquired a product which I think the previous owners were called Astaro, but it's called the UTM. UTM 9 is the current version, and UTM stands for Universal Threat Mitigation or something like that. Universal something something. But the point is that it has email filtering and web filtering and all these kind of things. And you can actually get an Amazon machine instance and just fire that up straight on EC2. You've got to obviously bring your license for the software, but it only costs you something like 1 cent more an hour to run that instance than just to run a bare instance and install it yourself. So it was super easy to set up and get working. And there's various, you know, one-click configurations for web filtering and so on. My only concern with all of these products is that they're all enterprise software, and therefore you can't figure out the price without getting on somebody's mailing list, which is one of my pet peeves with all of this stuff. And I imagine, having heard of the price of some of these products, I know you, what is it you use, Bradley? Is it Smoothwall?
Or Sonic Wall.
Websites? Sonic Wall. The price of some of these things can be astronomical, you know?
You end up spending, I really feel like I spend 10% of my budget every year on content filtering renewals between SonicWall and OpenDNS. And if I get to, I am really considering long term to just using OpenDNS. There are websites that I feel like that I can get to personally that SonicWall doesn't catch. And, mm-hmm. And I just think that there's no, it's like, how often does this thing update? And I just like OpenDNS's model better. And so, and we just have two because I didn't trust SonicWall, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. That whole model of feature licensing, like, you know, and not knowing, you know, how much it costs. Like, just take me to a website, show me how much the product costs, and let me buy it.
Exactly. Absolutely. And interesting piece of information I found out about that as well was that apparently OpenDNS are coming out with a new product called Umbrella, which is kind of shrouded in mystery, but it's apparently coming out next month, and it is billed as being security for your mobile users wherever they are. That's all they're telling at the moment. So we'll maybe come back to that and update people on that once it ships and see what it does. But it sounds attractive, and we're fans of OpenDNS here, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So the next topic is determining the ownership model of buy versus lease. You know, personally, I don't like to lease anything, but we lease everything here internally. What do you guys do?
Well, our iPad acquisition was the first lease that our school had ever done for equipment. I think we maybe leased a photocopier once before, but that was it. We'd never leased computer equipment. The first lab deployment I did in our current building was in 2006, and we purchased that outright. It was an Xserve G5, a dozen iMacs. We spent, must have been about £23,000 at that time, just bought the whole kit and owned it and deployed it. I realized what happens when you own your equipment is that every year that it comes up for renewal, there's always some pressure, and there's a conversation that you have to have there. So I've come to believe that our leasing structure has been integral to our success. And I'll tell you why I think that is because to bring people on board with a program like this, I think you have to give them confidence that it's for the long term. And you know, it's always an election year somewhere. There's always magic pots of money can be found for this or that or the next thing. And I've seen that happen too many times where school gets a grant to buy some equipment. They use it really well for the first year, use it a bit less the second year. By the third year, it's getting a bit old and creaky, and nobody knows if it's ever going to be refreshed. So people start pulling away from it. And I wanted to make sure that wasn't going to happen. So we decided to lease. And that was our first ever lease. And it's worked out pretty well. You know, we're 3 years, near 2.5 years into it. We'll have a refresh, and we have to have a refresh next year because all the devices we have at the moment go back to Apple, and we will sign some new lease for some new equipment for some new length of time.
And you know, it's one of the things interesting with Macs versus iPads. Like our Mac, all of our teachers have MacBooks. Then we have a mobile MacBook lab. We did those on a 3-year lease, and that's coming up. We paid it off now. I think we may still owe Apple $1 to actually, a dollar buyback. So we may still owe them $1 to actually own the devices. But so I had some teachers at the beginning of the year say, hey, my battery's not lasting that much longer. This is the beginning of the school year, so this is August. Mm-hmm. And so I can say, look, we're getting new gear in March. If I replace your battery, I have to replace everybody's. And I actually just had this conversation with somebody today that, look, I can't spend $2,000 to $3,000 on batteries for computers that we're getting rid of. It's just, we're just going to have to hang on. And really with the iPad, you know, 3 years is work great on the Mac, because the Mac mm-hmm. hardware, while it's obviously there's a difference between a 2009 MacBook and a 2012 MacBook Pro, ultimately they still pretty much function the same. You've got just some different ports here and there. Both of them can run Mountain Lion. They can all, you know, they can run all that. But with the iPad, you know, you've got the iPad 1 that mm-hmm. cannot run iOS 6. And so going forward, your application limitations are going to be limited.
Yeah, that's going to be an issue basically between now and next May. And I knew that was going to happen at some point in the lifetime of this lease. And I'm kind of gratified that it's held off till this point. I was concerned that maybe it would be 18 months into a 3-year lease that we would lose support for the operating system, for example. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things for mobile devices, we're not doing too badly. Obviously, as with everything Apple, you would like to know a bit more about what's going to happen in the future, but that's not the world we live in, and that's never going to be Apple. So there's no point griping about that, I suppose.
Well, and one of the things, too, is I think the iPad 1 may have been the anomaly on the OS upgrades, because we really don't, you know, we'll know some more next year, but we don't know what's going to happen with the iPad 2 and its OS situation. Now, will they keep that around at the end of next spring? Will they drop that to $299 and there'll be a $299, a $399, and a $499 model? We don't know. And so if they hang around, if the iPad 2 continues to get updates, then I think you could comfortably plan on maybe 3 years for an iPad. But if it doesn't, if we look at that, you know, the OS for the iPads is 2 years, you may need to look at a 2-year lease.
Yes, I'm certainly going to be having that debate with myself and with some other people over the next 6 months as to what we do for the next generation. I mean, Apple is generally very faithful in supporting devices that have recently been on sale for a good length of time. You know, so the iPhone 3GS only just stopped being sold, you know, two or three months ago. The 3GS was a current product, so it's foreseeable that we will get reasonable software support for the 3GS for the next year and a half, maybe, and so on. And what typically happens is that you'll get new versions of the OS, but you might not get all the features, right? You know, I mean, the iPad 1 doesn't have a camera, for example. But I think the iPad 1 is very, I'm thinking about it very much like the iPhone, the original iPhone. If you remember that product, it was very much, well, we kind of just got over the line to making the product. So, you know, it was only just good enough to ship, basically. Whereas the subsequent generations, they actually had more power, more memory, longer lasting, you know. So now we've got the iPad 3, which is, you know, well, the original iPad was like 256 megs of memory.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 128? I can't remember.
I think it was 256.
256. And now we're up to, what is it, a gig?
A gig.
And the current one? Yeah. You know, so 4X.
Well, and yeah, that's true. And see, and you've got to make the decision with your, you know, what model you're getting. Do you, okay, like if you're buying, you know, if you look at, say, your situation, let's say you were looking at a new lease today, and you say, okay, I want to do a 3-year lease. And you look at, well, say, look, let's get these iPad 2s. They're $400. And if you do a bulk buy, you can get them for $390 US a piece. Well, but you're doing a 3-year lease on a product that's already a year old.
Yeah. I'm very concerned about that. You know, that's hardware that is aging. That's why it's cheaper. It's cheaper to make. And 3 years is a long time in mobile devices, you know. There are things that are now possible today that were never possible in 2010. iTunes Match, iCloud, all these different things, you know. Some of the software, when you look at something like iPhoto, for example, we had no idea that something that powerful would be available. And then the cameras are getting bigger and stuff as well. So, again, storage is something we've talked about before. And, you know, you have to also decide not only is the hardware fast enough, but are we sizing the device appropriately as well for what it is we're doing?
Yeah, I agree. And going back to the lease versus buy, I think it's much easier for an organization to budget for lease payments than it is to budget for big capital expenditures. So if you we've got our lease will probably be around $90,000. Well, it's a lot easier for me to include, you know, a $30,000 lease payment into our yearly budget than it is to write a check for $90,000. A, just from a budgeting and a cash flow perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So there's a couple of other things around leasing that we should probably talk about as well. And one is, should you have the school do the lease, or should you facilitate a situation where parents can individually lease devices? And this is more of this is something that has very profound implications for the long term of your deployment, because in some ways, it's very attractive to offer parents a lease, right? So you now have an opportunity to buy an iPad at this special rate that we've negotiated with all these special conditions, and that's fine, right? But the problem, you have to think about year 4 and 5 and 6. And one of the big arguments, I think, against having individuals lease devices and then bring them into school is that once you've done that the first time, you don't really have control over when it happens again. Right. Mm-hmm. So think about, imagine if I had leased all these iPad 1s to parents in 2010. We're now in 2012. We're going to 2013, let's say. iPad 1s haven't been supported for 6 months. How do I get all those parents to lease again? Right. Unless you can somehow specify, well, you can only bring an iPad if it's, you know, less than 3 years old, which I think is probably a difficult sell for a lot of parents. If you do it on a school basis, then you have complete control over when devices get refreshed. And I think that's important, because the more of a mix, you know, we've talked about this before with the BYOD topic, but the more you mix it up, the more your support costs are going to rise. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, you know, if I leased iPad 1s for 100 children in 2010, and this year I've got 115 in the class, what did those last 15 get? Or in the school, rather. What device do those last 15 pupils have? Do they have iPad 1? Do they have iPad 2? What happened actually for us this year was that about 20% of our student population turned over. So we had a lot of kids left the school and a lot of new kids came to the school this year. And if I had done individual leases to the home, all of those kids that left would have taken those devices with them. And all those new kids, I would have had to facilitate a new lease for all of them, and that would not have been on an iPad 1. So those new kids would have had some newer device. Now, that's not in principle a massive problem when you're specifying the device very closely, but it could just start to get a little complicated, I think, and a little inconsistent.
I agree. I think it's just easier. You know, I don't know, this may be a terrible analogy, but we provide the desk for the students, and we don't ask them to bring their own desk because, well, can we fit it in the door? Does it fit in the classroom layout? We provide the desk for them.
Yeah.
We find out what works best, what fits in the classroom, and what our maintenance staff can repair.
Yeah. No, I think that's a perfect analogy. You know, it's as fundamental as your chair, you know, and I think the more consistent you can make that, the easier a time you're going to have. So that's why I'm a big fan of school leasing if it can be done. I recognize that it can't always be done, and the schools don't always necessarily have the authority to sign that scale of lease themselves. But there are, whatever sort of organizational level you have to get that to happen at, I think there are some very good arguments to be made for doing it en masse for the whole organization at once. And this is the way we have it, is that if a pupil leaves the school, they will return their iPad.
It seems,
and those iPads will get recycled for new pupils coming
in. It's just simpler, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree.
So do you want to take a quick sponsor break?
Let's do that.
All right. Great new sponsor this week. It's EasyGrade. It's an iPhone app that it replaces the old school cardboard EasyGrader. This app is a no-brainer. It's 99 cents. It's in the App Store. It's the best EasyGrader application in the App Store. Super simple to configure. It even works if you grade with partial credit. Allows you to calculate grades based on half or whole points. Some of the other great features, you can adjust the number of questions just with a quick tap. You can choose whether you want to calculate grades based on the number of answers that were correctly answered or incorrectly answered. Easily decrease or increase the font size. Now, I'll tell you, this is big because I see a lot of our teachers' personal iPhones, and they've really cranked up the font. And so, Paul, the developer of this application, is really, you can tell he really understands teachers. I believe his wife is actually a teacher, and he built this for her. And so, you know, he's got somebody testing it that really, really understands teachers. And to me, this is big. It's already been updated for the iPhone 5 and iOS 6. One of my major frustrations when looking at apps that are built for education is when I look at something, it was last updated in 2010. And so, you know, he's right on, he's on the ball. It's already updated for the iPhone 5 and the bigger screen. It's, again, 99 cents in the App Store. I sent the link out to our entire staff. I've had all kinds of people just buying it on the spot. I'm actually talking to my headmaster, and we may just gift it to all of the rest of our staff as a kind of an early Christmas bonus. Again, it's 99 cents. It's at easygradeapp.com. Again, Paul's great. He's supporting the show. So let's go. If you manage IT for a school, if you have some money left in your volume purchase program account, just get this to your teachers. It's kind of a no-brainer at 99 cents. EasyGradeApp.com, and we'll have a link in the show notes.
Okay. Next step, we're going to talk about damage and damage recovery and all the problems that come around, what happens when everything goes bad. So there's a couple of topics here, or subtopics rather. The first one, we'll talk a little bit about AppleCare and whether or not AppleCare is actually worth it. And then we'll talk a little bit about maybe who pays for problems, and then the actual mechanics of returning people to service, basically. So first things first, AppleCare, yes or no?
I am a no on AppleCare for the simple reason that if you're buying, let's say you're buying the low-end $399 iPad 2, 16 gigabyte. It's $100 for AppleCare, and it still has a $50 deductible after that. It doesn't cover it if it's lost or stolen. And for every four iPads you bought AppleCare for, you could have just bought another iPad as a backup. And so yep. I would rather either do that, or for every iPad that we buy, set $100 aside in your budget for repairs. We've got some people here locally that are obviously unauthorized that they can repair, you know, cracked screens and things like that. And we've had iPads since 2010. We got some the summer after they came out, and we at one point had as few as four, and we've scaled our way up to, we have 38 iPad 2s. I've never had one dropped.
Yeah, we have had, we've certainly had problems with our iPads, both in terms of accidental damage and occasional component failure as well. We also decided no on AppleCare. And the, like you said, we looked at it, you know, here's a bill for £8,500 for AppleCare, and that doesn't even cover accidental damage. I think at least half of our devices that have been replaced for accidental damage. The other half for things like home buttons getting sticky and LCD screens going. And now the thing is that most of those issues happened in the first year. So we had four or five devices replaced in the first year. Only one was for an actual accident.
Yeah, that's true. So to remember is you get the first year covered for, you know, manufacturer defects.
Yeah. So that's the thing is that, you know, if a button goes or a switch goes in the first year, then that's getting replaced for free anyway. So you're only talking about years two and three if you've got a three-year lease, and only talking about year two if you've got a two-year lease. So to my mind, it's not – there's sufficiently little that's likely to spontaneously go wrong with one of these things that it's really worth doing that. We have actually paid out of our pocket to have a few devices repaired or replaced, a couple of cracked screens, one or two that just wouldn't start up This is something I've actually seen happen a couple of times with iPads, is they get stored over the summer, and then when I come back to them, 1 out of 100 just won't start up again. And we've paid for a couple of replacements like that. But, you know, in total, we might have spent maybe £800 on iPad repairs over 2.5 years. And by this point, we would have spent £8,500, and we would have still paid for some of those repairs anyway.
Well, exactly. So, they wouldn't offer Apple Care unless it made them money. And obviously, if, you know, if you're a school that's got no tech person and it just does not want to deal with anything, and you've got the extra money, I guess, buy it. But I think you're better off to, if Apple's quote for Apple Care is $10,000, if you have the money, just set it in a repair budget. And if you need it, that's great. And if you don't, you save $10,000.
Well, here's the thing with Apple Care, right? Is that what's the difference between me getting an Apple Care repair and me not getting an Apple Care repair? I still have to do all the same stuff, except at the end of the transaction in the Genius Bar, instead of pulling out my credit card, I walk away for free. That's, you know, all the same mechanisms and all the same effort has to go in, regardless of whether or not you've got Apple Care and who's paying for it at the end of the day. So in general, I'm pretty down on Apple Care for iPads.
Well, and you know, going back to that point, you know, if you have a MacBook Pro Lab and you have a hard drive go bad, well, you can just have some spare hard drives and pop those in. You know, you don't have those options on iOS. You know, you're not replacing the flash memory if it goes bad. There is no self repair.
Absolutely. It's swap in and swap out.
And I don't think, and I talked to Apple, and said, well, do you think we'll ever see like a self-servicing program like we do for the Macs for iOS? And they said, no. We said, we generally, you know, the iPads are not, we don't consider those repairable by anyone, but, you know, really anyone. Most of the time, if it's something gone internally, they refurbish it and you get a refurbished one back.
Yeah.
You know, again, yeah. It's different. You know, they're not meant to be. You look at them like an appliance. They're not meant to really be taken apart.
Yeah. No. And you mentioned earlier, like third-party screen repair services and stuff. I have never been very convinced by any of that. Not as these screens get more complex and more tightly integrated in their manufacturer, like the iPhone 5.
We've got a guy here locally that he has a franchise from a company called iCracked.com. It's the letter I cracked. You know, you can see where they got that name from. But he does a pretty decent job. And the thing I like about him is it's a franchise that he's bought into. And mm-hmm. So his parts are tested. So it's not like he's going to Amazon and buying the screen and digitizer and hoping it works. He's actually has somebody he's buying the parts through, and they're testing them. He said that they let them know that if you have any problems with any parts, you know, fix it on the spot, no questions asked. And so, again, it's not ideal, but if you're in a pinch where you don't really have the money to buy a new one, but you can get something maybe fixed for $150, it's worth a shot. I think all depends on who you're using to fix it. If you've got a guy that you found on Craigslist that's buying the parts on Amazon, you know, who knows? My only experience in iOS repair is replacing the back of an iPhone 4 and 4S. A lot of our parents will crack screens in iPhones and ask me, hey, you know, Bradley, can you replace them? And I do not want to be able to do that. I'm okay with it because I just don't want to do it. It's not something I'm interested in fooling with. There's not enough money for me freelance in fixing iPhones. And there's a lot of downsides. If you break their phone or if you break, you know, something else, and not a good situation.
Yeah. So that's the kind of Apple Care part of the discussion. I guess the broader question for the school is really, when something bad happens, who is responsible for that? And there are various ways that can play out. And I think for most schools from now on, the answer is going to be that your lease company has probably got some insurance component in the lease price. And that's likely to be the answer to that for most people. We're in a funny situation because our lease is a business lease and not an educational lease because we were into it so early. So our lease doesn't actually include insurance. So we have covered damage. Sometimes parents have paid, sometimes the school has paid. It just depends. So, you know, in the case of iPads that were stored and went bad over the summer, the school would pay for that. Whereas a child that's taken their iPad home and dropped it on the step on the way in, the parents would pay for that. But one of the things that we did right in our acceptable use policy was it is down to Apple how much you pay for the repair, right? So basically what happens is we'll take it to the Apple store, I'll pay them whatever they're going to charge me, and then I'll charge the parents that money. And they can insure that risk if they want to. They can pay it out of their own pocket if they want to. That's up to them for now. But I think going forward, almost every educational lease that goes out that I've heard of, the lease company is requiring some kind of insurance to go along with it.
Well, that makes sense. It's just when, you know, when we have a loan for our house, they require us to have homeowners insurance. And it just really, the iPad is the leasing company's asset. And if you can break it, then that asset is not worth as much to them. I see on the notes, like, you know, talking about spares. How many do you have? Mm-hmm. Any spares that you keep on site?
Well, our initial plan was to carry 5 spares. The school's actually grown so much in the past couple of years that it's eaten up all my spares. So I've now deployed every single iPad I have. But I think the answer to this depends very much on how quickly you can get a replacement, right? Because I have got, within half an hour's drive from my house, I've got 2 Apple stores. So if somebody presents me with a broken device at lunchtime, I can have their device backed up and restored onto new hardware by the end of school. And then I get in my car, I drive half an hour to the Apple store, and I get a new device for the next morning. And because I've got that facility to turn around the repair very fast, for our next lease, I'm not planning to carry more than 1% additional capacity for spares.
I think
now,
Apple...
If it took you months to get a replacement, then you should probably have more than that.
I think I want to say Apple's official recommendation is 1-2%. And so you'd certainly want to talk to your Apple rep about that. But I think when I last talked to them, they were recommending 2%. See, our problem in Chattanooga is the closest Apple store is an hour and a half away. Now, we have Apple authorized, you know, resellers and repair shops near us, but none of those are licensed for the iPad. The iPad can only be done at Apple stores. And so it would take me, you know, an hour and a half drive to get something swapped out, and that's an hour and a half there and an hour and a half back. And so we will probably look at doing 2%. It's probably what we will end up doing.
Yeah, I guess the question is, how, after one device goes down, how likely are you to have another one go down before you can get the first one replaced? You know, the rate of failure and so on. So it's just something to think about vis-a-vis how many you have versus the size of your school. If you've got 1,000 pupils in your school, you know, that's a fairly chunky set of spares. You may want to look into doing what you can to get that turnaround time down.
Yeah.
Perhaps as a matter of urgency, rather than carrying, you know, 1% of 1,000 spares.
What do you guys use case-wise? And I think I've seen from your Twitter pictures, do you let the students pick their own case?
What we did initially was because it was 2010, there only was one case, and it was the Apple case. We've used that for 2.5 years now. We changed the policy about 6 months in because kids asked us to do it. They said, look, can we bring in our own case? And I said, yes, under 2 conditions. One is that it folds round to make a typing stand. 2 is that it folds closed to cover the screen of the device. As long as your case does that, I don't care what else.
We're in a cart situation, so our students are taking them home. And, you know, I see other schools and they, you know, they have a 50 iPads and they have like these heavy duty Griffin cases that are $50 to $60 per case. And it's really the same argument with the AppleCare. If I'm spending $50 to $60 per iPad on a case, that's a lot of money. And so what we did for our original iPad 1s is we found these cases on Amazon that are basically rubber silicone, and they cost $3. And it worked fantastic. And when it came time, we deployed our 2 iPad 2 carts, I found black rubber cases on Amazon that were about $3 a piece, and they worked well. We don't use Apple's official carts. We actually use just laptop rolling bags, and there's 18 in there. They slide in there very nicely, and it's worked out well. And it's one of those things, you know, at $3 a pop, it's kind of, and if it works, it's kind of a good situation. Now, again, we're not doing as much typing as you guys probably are, certainly in your upper grades. And so we're not concerned about the typing stand at, you know, for our grade. But certainly if I had middle school and high schoolers that were typing full length reports on there, that would be a necessity.
Yeah. I think, though, that the idea of having a case that will close to cover the screen is a very important aspect, not just because of protection, but it's also a tool for classroom management. Because if you need the attention of the class, you can say, well, everybody close your iPads. And if you have people whose cases don't actually close, then it's harder to verify that than you just having a quick glance around the classroom and seeing that everybody's case is closed over. So that's a little trick that we like to use in the classroom. So, yeah, I've seen people do everything with cases. You know, I've seen people do the very cheapest thing. I've seen people just get the Apple official thing. And I've seen people just defend these things like as if Batman was taking it onto the streets of Gotham. And I don't know where I come down on that. I think I have a sense, and I don't have numbers to back this up, so nobody from Apple phone me up on this one, please. But my sense is that the iPad 1 is actually a bit more robust than the iPad 2 and 3 when it comes to drops. That's just my impression from talking to different schools. I've talked to schools where they've had breakage rates much, much higher than ours. But there's so many factors in that I couldn't just say that it was purely the difference between the two designs. But that's my sense. I'm using the Apple Smart Case, which is like the smart cover with the back on it, and I quite like that. It kind of has the spirit of the original Apple case, and it seems to work quite well.
Yeah, I use a smart cover, and then I have a smart cover compatible back, and it's kind of a hard mm-hmm. case, and I like it. I got it. I use the same smart cover for my iPad 2, and then picked up this back when they were released. I think I paid $15 on Amazon for it, and it works. It does not have a magnetic strip like the one from my iPad 2 did, and I really like that because when you flipped open the smart cover, it would actually latch onto the back of the back case and would kind of hold it in place. But yeah, it's interesting to see Apple making cases. I don't know why I find that interesting, but I do.
Well, it certainly, when I first saw the smart case, I thought, well, that's Apple heard the cry of education, because I do not think that the smart cover is suitable for schools at all in any way. I've seen too many just issues happen with that, with the case coming off and then the device falling and so on. I don't think the magnetic smart cover is suitable for schools. And this kind of has, it's got the smart cover top, but then it's got a wrapper and back part to it as well. And it's pretty good, but you know, it certainly hasn't slowed down the flood of other types of cases that have come out on the market before and since.
Yeah, it's funny. We talk about Apple listening to education. It's you see a lot of the innovations in the Mac, and a lot of those really came from education. I really believe that the MagSafe adapter was coming from students pulling laptops off a desk. I really believe the slot loading drive was a something that really impacted education as well. And they really listened to education because education spends a lot of money with them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my only gripe about the smart cover is that it's quite expensive.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's like £39 in the UK, which is, I mean, we leased the Apple case because it was the only case that was available for the first iPad at the time. But for the next one, I'll certainly be looking a bit wider than just whatever they've got on the shelf in the Apple store.
Yeah, yeah. It's, and this is the great thing about where we are in the ecosystem is there's a ton of options. You can really find whatever you want case-wise, various pricing points to level of covers of protection.
Yeah. I think you also your choice there also is affected a little bit by what it is you're going to do with the iPad. So in my situation, these iPads are going into school bags, they're getting laid around the school, they're going home, they're going to different places. So something pretty robust like the smart case or something equivalent, it's worth me spending a little bit more on that. Whereas in a situation like yours and some other schools where they're on a trolley or they're in a cart and they're coming out in the classroom, but they're going back into that cart and they're not being transported around, you know, outside the school very much, you can probably use a simpler case. I think you've really got to think through the life cycle of what does your device do during a day and night and second day before you can really get a handle on exactly what kind of case you're looking for.
Yeah, that's true. What's the next topic?
Next one, and this is a big one. We could have two shows on this alone probably, but very briefly, app ownership. Because this is the one thing, if you get this wrong at the start, you're going to have a hard year and then you're going to have to do it all over again. So The way that Apple presents this, if you go to any of their iPad deployment sessions, is they talk about three different models of deployment. Okay, there's a continuum, there's two extremes, and there's an option in the middle. Okay, so the two extremes are the personal model, which is, as you might expect, you hand over a shrink-wrapped iPad to an individual, and they basically treat it like their own. Okay. The institution has no involvement in buying any applications for it or installing any applications or doing any real kind of management on the device. It's just carte blanche to do whatever you like. Just here's your iPad, show up with it. And that's a model that works quite well in university settings. I know, for example, Abilene Christian University in Texas, when they were very early into giving their freshmen iPhones back in the day, and that was pretty much what they did. You would go and do your matriculation, and then you'd be like, there's your iPhone, see you later. And that's very much the personal model. The individual has their own Apple ID, they buy all the content, they own all the content, and depending on the funding model, either they keep the device at the end or they'll hand it back. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is what they call the institutional model, which is pretty much what I've done at Cedars, where the school owns a device, the school deploys the device, the school purchases all the applications, and the individual has very little autonomy to modify the configuration of the device at all. And those are kind of the two endpoints of that situation. Since Apple Configurator came out and Volume Purchase came out, there's now a thing you can do called the layered model, which is a little bit of both. And the way the layered model works is that you use Apple Configurator to set up the device, update it to the latest operating system, and then install volume purchased applications. Now, if you stop at that point, that's you've done the institutional model, right? You've set up the device, you've put the apps on, and that might be all you want to do. But if you want to do a layered model and let the individual have some autonomy on top of that, what you can then do is you pull the Apple device off Configurator and you hand it over to the student. What the student then sees, their experience of the first run of this device, is they turn it on and it's showing the iOS setup assistant. They go through the setup assistant and set up with their own personal information. And then when they unlock the device, it looks like they've just set up a brand new iPad, except when you swipe onto the second screen, there's a bunch of apps that have already been installed. So that's the idea of the layered model. But what's happening there is that the student has their own Apple ID on the device, so they can go into the store, they can download apps, videos, content, and they can also back up their device to their own iCloud account, including the data that was made in applications that the school deployed. So the layered model is mostly personal, with some content delivered before the device is set up by Apple Configurator, and that content belongs to the institution. So in that layered model, at the end of the year, the student can peel off their layer because all their data is backed up in iCloud and they own their apps. And then the school can peel off their layer and recover those licenses in Configurator. And then the device is ready to use again the next year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I need to figure out what this means. In Apple Configurator 1.2, which came out, I guess, probably last week or the week before last.
Last week, I think it was.
There's a note that said paid apps from the App Store can now be installed in the prepare pane only when a device is being supervised. And mm-hmm. so I don't know if that means that you have to prepare it, and then in the in that middle tab is where you, I guess that's where you would install your applications now. I'm just trying to figure out what that means, because this is certainly relevant to the layered model. I don't know what that means.
My understanding of what that means is that you could always install apps in the prepare tab or in the prepare tab, or what's the middle one called? Supervise. You could always do it in both places. But what they're doing now, I understand, is that they are restricting what you can do in prepare to only be available to supervised devices. So previously, you could supervise or not, and then install applications regardless. Whereas now they're saying if you want to install your applications under prepare, you've got to be supervising the device at the same time.
So where will you install the applications if they're not supervised?
You would do that in the middle tab, I believe.
I think that's supervision.
Yeah.
know.
It's a little confusing, the terminology, I have to admit.
Well, I had a really bad upgrade to 1.2. I had to end up – and this is why you really want to make good Time Machine backups or clones of your – of the machine that is kind of controlling Configurator, because mm-hmm. I upgraded to – I was running Lion on that machine, and I upgraded to 1.2, and it just wouldn't launch. And got on the phone with Apple Enterprise. We went through a lot of troubleshooting steps, basically determined something in my Apple Configurator database was corrupt. And so my options were to either restore from a good backup or to start over and have all my codes be – my app codes be reissued, which would be a catastrophe. So thankfully, I had a backup of right before I upgraded to 1.2 and just restored from it. Then I went and upgraded to Mountain Lion and upgraded Mountain Lion to 10.8.2, and it worked fine. I actually had somebody from Apple responding to me on Twitter, which is, again, another reason I love Twitter, that an Apple employee was helping me. But so I'm looking at it right now. You get the prepare pane, the supervise pane, and the assign pane. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any iPads plugged up, so I don't know. I'm very confused.
Yeah, they're basically reusing the term supervise a couple of times here for what I think are not exactly equivalent things.
Yeah.
There's device supervision, which is the mode that you can put the device in where it will not sync with any iTunes. It will only sync with Configurator on that one Mac. And then there's the idea of installing applications and checking them in and out to users.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think that's what's going on there. I have yet to sit down with Configurator 1.2. And really get my teeth into it, but I'm going to have to do that over the next little while.
It's a great update. The new iOS 6 MDM APIs are great. You can turn off iMessage. You can disable the erotica section in the bookstore. It's really cool. Like if you have a lab of iPads you're going to use for an exam, you can turn on guided access for a certain app right from within Configurator, and so you can refresh that lab, and then they're ready to go. They're tied to that application.
Yeah, that's going to be useful for us because we've done that before with our digital exams are basically PDF forms, and we've done them on the iPad. But there were a couple of things that we couldn't close out completely, and we had to rely on the proctoring in the room to make sure that people weren't actually doing these things. But what we can do, one of the things that we did before was that we used spare iPads to set them up for the exam. And what we'll be able to do with guided access... and this is not really a Configurator issue as much as a gated access feature, is that we could actually just use the student's own iPad and lock them into the PDF application through gated access, and then once they're done with the exam, get them out of it again. So that would be pretty powerful if we could do that.
And one of the things that when we looked at our my setup for our iPads is I don't try to go through a lot of customization of how the apps are laid out, putting them in a folder by subject or type of app or grade level, because there's no way to lock those to where they're at. And so if you do it one time and, if a student has it for 2 days, they're going to rearrange them. And so my opinion, don't waste your time with that. Get them on there. If they have trouble finding applications, they can use the search function.
Yeah, and the thing as well is that there's no one taxonomy you could apply to that would make sense for every situation.
Right.
Some teachers, just thinking about the ways that I've seen kids organize their home screen for their own iPad, never mind for a whole class, but I've seen kids do things where they'll have a folder for A applications and a folder for B applications and so on. I've also seen kids organize their applications by color. So here's all the blue applications and here's all the green applications and so on. Teachers might want them done in different ways, and some people like to talk about Bloom's taxonomy and organize apps by their appropriateness for that taxonomy or something else, or learning styles or something. So it would be very hard, I think, to certainly in any larger setting to satisfy everybody's way of thinking about applications.
So I guess really from here we can kind of segue into the next section about determining your management platform. We talked a little bit about how Apple Configurator works, and for us, Apple Configurator is all we're using for management. There are obviously a lot of great mobile device management solutions. You've got Jamf, Maz 360, Meraki makes one that's actually free. You've got a lot of them out there. But for us, the expense of those, we just didn't gain a whole lot that Apple Configurator doesn't do.
Yeah. I think this is very much – there's two factors play into your choice here, really, apart from cost, which is obviously something that everybody's concerned about. But based on what we just talked about with the app ownership model, if you have a completely personal model, how much control do you need over that device? Maybe you want to be able to push out new configuration profiles. If you're changing proxies or VPNs or something, you may want to be able to support users just pushing out profiles but nothing else. Whereas if you have a completely institutional model, you may hope to be able to do more with your MDM there, or do things like locating the device, which is something that some schools might care about. Whereas in the middle, my sense with MDM is that if you're going to do the layered model, then MDM is a slightly trickier fit for that, because you then have content that is some of it's owned by the school, some of it's owned by the individual. And one of the kind of holy grails of MDM deployment is everybody wants to be able to push apps wirelessly to devices. And you can do that with certain MDM providers. But the problem is that what you're doing is you're essentially pushing a coupon code to the device. And what you cannot do, as far as I understand, unless the pupils have your Apple ID password, which is not something you want to do, you can't push out an institutionally owned application to devices wirelessly.
Well,
am I right?
Well, I think depending on the provider, the issue, because if you have that coupon code, I know I've tinkered with Meraki's a little bit. You can plug in a code from the App Store and push the app, but you've got no way to ever get that code back.
Yes, because what's happening there is you're sending a coupon code to the device. But then the individual needs to provide their Apple ID password to redeem the code.
And it says you will not be charged. Like, it'll ask them to enter your passcode. You will not be charged for this. And I guess if that's the model you want to go with, that's fine. But that's why Apple Configurator was such a breath of fresh air. And if we didn't have Apple Configurator, we'd have a whole different discussion on MDM solutions. But the great thing about Configurator is you can get those back when they leave. If you've got 100 copies of Keynote, when those students graduate, you can get those licenses back. If you use something that's built into your MDM provider, you have lost those licenses.
You're essentially you can use MDM as a way to distribute coupon codes, but it is conceptually no different to printing out your spreadsheet, cutting it up, and giving those codes away on paper.
Oh, yeah.
It's just an automated way of doing that.
Exactly.
If that makes sense. As far as I understand it, there is no way to retrieve a deployed license except when you deployed it through Apple Configurator the first time.
That is 100% correct. Inside that spreadsheet, you can also send them a link. And there may be a reason to do that. Let's say you've charged parents an app fee, mm-hmm. At the beginning of the year for, hey, we're going to charge you $30 for iWork. And then you can email them their coupon codes and say, hey, here's your iWork that you paid for. Then that's fine. But if the school's paying for them, it would be my advice, especially because Configurator is free, to do your app deployments through Configurator. Now, I would love it if there was a way we could, through some Apple-sanctioned way, work with the VPP program and push them out wirelessly, but today there's not.
Yeah, and I think so much of the sort of subsequent decisions are determined by what you do about app ownership. Wherever you land on that spectrum of layered, personal, institutional, you may find that an MDM solution is just absolutely not required. We, for example, we use Meraki MDM, but I don't actually do anything with it. It's just there if I need it. We are actually just using iTunes for deployment. I mean, I'm not recommending that as something for any new deployment to do, but that's the situation we're in. And the reason we're in that situation is because all of our devices return to base frequently, right? A lot of these MDM solutions were originally invented for corporate types to manage 10,000 BlackBerries that are roaming all over the world, and you will never get those 10,000 devices back in the same building ever. So you've got to have something that works wirelessly. Whereas in a lot of school situations, you will typically have all your devices on site every single day. And that can lead you to be able to do different things depending on the scale, I suppose.
Let's see what else we've got here. Teacher development, I believe, was mm-hmm. our next section.
Yeah. It's an interesting one. You can get this really right or you can get this really wrong. And I think one of the things I always say to people that I think is really important is that teachers use the iPad as well. Because I've seen very strange things happen when the kids have got iPads and the teachers have only got a laptop and they've never really used an iPad before. Because what happens then is that the teachers tend to assume that, well, of course you will be able to just pick a file out from somewhere and open it in the email program to send it as an attachment. Now, you can do that in many applications, but the process for doing it is different, right? You don't open your email program, then go and find the file and attach it. You go and find the file, then you send it as an email attachment, right? So there's just some subtle workflow things that are different. And occasionally, there are some very not subtle workflow things that are total showstoppers. And I've been in situations where I've seen lessons just hit the buffers halfway through because something the teacher thought was possible on an iPad or assumed it was possible on an iPad turned out not to be possible at all. Like, everybody on the iPad, go to the Z drive on the network and download this file. Well, what do you mean by that? You know, and suddenly that's a lesson just completely lost. So teachers have to understand the iPad and have to live with it as well. It is really important. But I wanted to mention one kind of conceptual framework for technology and education called the SAMR model, which people may have heard of. It's relatively well known now. It's SAMR is spelled S-A-M-R, and it's an acronym. The whole framework is due to a researcher called Ruben Puntadura, who is an educational consultant out of Boston, and he derived this framework from, I believe, I'm doing this from memory, but I think it was, he was involved in researching the state of Maine's one-to-one laptop deployment. And anecdotally, not formally, this is what I think how it came to pass, was that the state of Maine deployed 50,000 iBooks to all the schools in the state. And what they found was that some schools took off with the device very quickly, and other schools sort of did quite pedestrian things with it. And one of the questions that was put to Ruben was, what is different between these rock star schools and these pedestrian schools as to what they're doing in the classroom? And what he kind of identified was these four stages of adoption. And S in SAMR stands for substitution, which is defined as the digital replacing the analog without any functional improvement. So the classic example is, instead of writing the essay, you type the essay. A stands for augmentation, so replace the analog with some functional improvement, such as a typed essay that's been spell-checked and grammar-checked. And then M and R stand for modification and redefinition. So when you modify the lesson to take account of the technology that's in your hands, and when you completely redefine the learning that happens in the classroom based on the fact you've got the technology available to you. Examples of that might be that you can modify the lesson by maybe using templates and writing the story electronically and using another app to help you structure the story first. And then redefinition might be something like, well, we're not going to write an essay at all. Maybe we're going to shoot a video on our iPad. So there's a framework like that that I often use when I'm doing consulting with schools. And when I describe this, I like to explain it as these aren't four grades of awesomeness. Right, it's not, if you're just substituting, it doesn't mean you suck and somebody who is redefining their classroom is amazing. What that means is that you're just getting started and they've been on the path a bit longer. And teachers can often be very overwhelmed by just how do you get into using the iPad in the classroom. And I always bring people right back to the start and say, well, how do you teach physics? What do you do in the classroom when you teach physics, for example? And they'll say, well, we'll do an experiment and we'll time how long it takes for this thing to move from here to here. So, okay, so stop there. Can you replace that stopwatch device with an app on your iPad? Well, sure I can. There's 100 stopwatch applications in the App Store. Okay, let's get one of them and just do that today. Don't do anything else. That's fine. And then, okay, how about next week? Maybe we can one kid can be using the stopwatch application, the other kid can record the numbers in the spreadsheet. Okay, that's an augmentation task, fine. And then we can start to modify, and then we can redefine. Examples of redefinition always seem to end up with video, but you can do other things as well. Maybe we can write up our logbooks as an electronic book, for example, or something like that. I'm making these examples off the top of my head. But these are the kind of things you can do. And I think that gives teachers a lot of confidence to start small and build up. And it's really, really important that management in a school understands that you have to start that way. Nobody can be amazing on the first day unless they were pretty much already amazing to start with. I think that's a very useful framework to think about the way that you can grow into your deployment. And again, the other thing about that is all the way back to the start of this conversation, buy versus lease. If these teachers don't believe that this is for real and for the long term, then you're going to have a hard time getting people to buy in, regardless of which framework you use or how you coach them or whatever. If they think this is all going to go away tomorrow, then it's going to be difficult. And I've seen some schools where they've been given a set of iPads and they've been told, right, this is from August to Christmas for you. And the teachers are like, well, so what? You know, what am I going to do with that between now and Christmas? What's the point in me even trying to stretch beyond substitution, because it's all going to go away and I'm going to be back to pen and paper? So one of the biggest things you can do is give people confidence that your deployment is forever, basically. I mean, things will change, of course, but if people think it's going away very quickly, you're not going to get them to start thinking about those longer term and higher function things that they can do with the device.
Yeah, they need to feel like that it's something the school is sold on, you know, that it's not just a fly-by-night thing, that's not something we're doing just because it's cool or we got some grant money this year. It needs to be something that's, you know, a vision from the school, that's, you know, from the headmaster down.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the thing is, this is what we know about all improvement in schools, is that the crucial factor is school leadership. It doesn't matter whether it's, starting up a breakfast club or an after-school homework club or starting sports teams or starting an outdoor adventure program or even just bringing a new subject into the curriculum. If the school leadership isn't doing a leadership job on that, then that's not going to succeed. And technology is no better or worse, and it's not inevitable. This is the thing that people sometimes make a mistake in thinking, and this is often the mentality behind BYOD discussions, is that they seem to think that there's some kind of crushingly inevitable wave of technology that will just obviously have to work in the school. Sooner or later, it will have to happen, right? Not understanding that there's so much organizational momentum that it could quite conceivably never happen, or it could be delayed 20 to 25 years, after the stage in which it's happened in society. So there's a lot of things to think about in there, but it's not magic. Right? There's not something special you have to do with technology when it comes to school leadership, any more than if you were hiring a new teacher or bringing in a new program or something like that. School leadership has got to do a leadership role. And schools with successful leadership, who crucially have control of what the school does, can be very quickly successful with this. Schools that have good leadership, but that leadership is disempowered by some larger organizational structure, can find it very difficult. Or schools where the leadership is just simply not strong can also suffer a little bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, technology is just technology. And just as if we launched a new curriculum last year and it was a school-wide focus and it was full tilt from day one, this was our vision. And it's been successful because of that. But if you don't, it's just anything in life, if you don't give it everything you've got, you're probably going to fail.
Couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's also one of these things where you've got to talk about your vision as well. Having the vision is fine, but if only two or three people in the leadership office know that they've got that vision and everybody else is kind of like, well, here's another random thing that's been visited upon us from on high, then, you're maybe not going to carry everybody with you either. It's always worth talking about your values, and you can't over-communicate about this stuff, either to parents, to pupils, or to staff. All of those things have got to happen at the same time.
That's true. I think that's all I've got. Do you have anything else you want to add?
For me, that's the show. That's the story right there.
Well, again, thanks to EasyGrade for sponsoring the show. It's a no-brainer purchase if you're a teacher or you know a teacher, you have teachers that you support. It's 99 cents in the App Store. It supports the show, EasyGradeApp.com. We'll have links to a lot of things we talked about in the show notes. So you can, if you subscribe on iTunes, you can see those at outofschool.net. Or if you subscribe in a podcasting app for Android or the iPhone, they'll be right there in there with the show. Frazier, enjoy your holiday next week.
Thanks very much.
We'll have somebody from Aerohive on the show. He is a highly rated wireless expert. He is CWNE number 87. But this is not an Aerohive show. We're going to be talking about a lot of just typical wireless technology. So if you've already got wireless, you've already got a Cisco, a Ruckus, or an Aruba deployment, this will still be a great show for you to listen to because it's not an Aerohive commercial. And so we're going to have a lot of fun next week. I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers and on the web at chambersdaily.com.
Spears.org is my blog, Fraser Spears on Twitter. And I guess we'll see you next time. I'll see you two times from now.
All right.
You'll be back next week.
Have a good week.